June 29th, 1991. New York City. Korean immigrant Suya Kim leaves her children with her grandmother to go shopping, but never returns. 10 hours later, Suya's nude body is discovered in a dumpster after she has been stabbed 9 times. A security guard reports interacting with an unidentified white male who drove away from the dumpster before the body's discovery, but even though the vehicle's license number is checked, the lead goes nowhere, and Suya's killer is never found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and we're going to be covering a pair of unsolved cold cases today. The 1991 murder of Suya Kim, and the 1997 murder of Quinn Rong-woo. These are both horrific stories about female victims who emigrated with their families to New York City from their home country in Asia in hopes of a better life before they were brutally murdered. The Suya Kim case is somewhat famous because it was featured on Unsolved Mysteries and is one of their most vivid segments. Suya was a hard-working Korean wife and mother who vanished after leaving on a shopping trip before her murdered body was discovered in a dumpster several hours later. What's particularly chilling about this story is that a security guard spoke with Suya's killer while he was in the midst of disposing of her body, but we still don't know who this man was or what his motive for the crime could have been. I've received numerous requests to cover this case, but the problem is that other than the Unsolved Mystery segment, there's virtually no information out there about it. So for this reason, I've decided to combine this story with the unsolved New York murder of Quinn Rong-woo, an 11-year-old Chinese immigrant who was strangled to death nearly 6 years later. This case is particularly unique, because while there was an eyewitness sighting of Quinn Rong with an unidentified man who might be her killer, there has also been suspicion that her own parents might have been involved in her death. While I see no indication that Suya and Quinn Rong's cases are connected, there are a number of parallels between these two crimes, which is why I decided to cover them both on today's episode. I'm going to begin by sharing the details about Suya's murder, as well as providing my own theories and analysis, and then I'll move on to Quinn Rong's case. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the unsolved murder of Suya Kim. Our story begins in New York City in 1991. Our central figure is Suya Kim, who currently lives in Queens with her husband of 10 years, Soo-young Kim, and their 2 sons. The couple originally hail from Seoul, South Korea, but decided to immigrate to the United States and move to New York. After spending years working in flea markets, the Kims finally saved up enough money to open their own clothing store in the Bushwick neighborhood of Brooklyn, and eventually expanded the business and opened up a second store in Long Island. The Kims spent the majority of their time at the Bushwick location and are known for being very hard-working people who are usually on the job 7 days per week. On Saturday, June the 29th, 5 days after celebrating her 10-year wedding anniversary with her husband, Suya decided to drop off her two sons with her grandmother at around 5 p.m. Soo-young was working at the time, so Suya needed someone to watch over the boys while she went shopping. When Soo-young returned home to their apartment at 8 p.m., he was surprised to see that his wife was not there. He called many of Suya's friends, but no one had seen her, and it was very out of character for her to stay out without telling anyone where she was. Soo-young was soon joined at the apartment by his brother, and when they checked the parking garage, they discovered that Suya's car was there, and since the engine was cold, it had not recently been driven. This greatly concerned Soo-young, and after staying up all night waiting to hear from his wife, his worst fears would be realized the following day when he was contacted by the police. He learned that Suya's body had been found, and they wanted him to come down to the medical examiner's office to identify her. Sure enough, when Soo-young traveled there and saw the body, he was able to confirm that the victim was his wife. She had been stabbed 9 times, and at around 3 a.m. that morning, her body was discovered inside a dumpster in the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn, 7 miles away from the Kims' apartment. Suya had been dead for hours before she was found, but even though her body was nude, she had not been raped. But it turned out there was a very promising lead involving her potential killer. During the early morning hours of June 30th, a private security guard named Joe Jones had been assigned to patrol an abandoned building at Bedford-Stuyvesant. At around 3 a.m., Jones came across a blonde white male who appeared to be in his mid-20s. He wore glasses and was dressed in a fishnet tank top and jogging shorts, and Jones saw him standing outside a blue Nissan parked in an alley next to the building. The man appeared to be placing something inside a dumpster, so Jones approached him and told him he was not allowed to dump his trash there. The man responded by pulling out a $20 bill and offering it to Jones if he would let him go about his business. Jones decided to accept the money, but when the man handed it to him, Jones noticed blood on his tank top, which also appeared to be torn. Jones asked where the blood came from, and the man mentioned something about getting into a fight before climbing into his vehicle and backing out of the alley into the street. For the next several seconds, Jones saw the man staring at him through the window before he finally drove away. Jones had already become suspicious enough that he made note of the car's license number, but his suspicions grew when Jones noticed spots of blood on the ground next to the dumpster. At this moment, a friend of Jones's just happened to walk by, so Jones asked if he would help him check inside the dumpster. They were soon shocked to discover Suya Kim's body buried underneath the trash. When Jones and his friend went to summon help, they were able to wave down an ambulance which was passing through the area. Jones was questioned by police, but as odd as his story about his encounter with the white male may have sounded, he passed a polygraph test, and investigators became convinced he was telling the truth and had no involvement with Suya's murder. But while Jones was able to provide them with the license number for the alleged killer's vehicle, this only raised more questions. The plate wound up matching a blue Nissan, the exact type of car which Jones had described, but it belonged to a female Taiwanese exchange student attending the CW Post campus of Long Island University. Investigators immediately went to the campus to question the student, but she denied any knowledge of the murder and claimed she had not driven her Nissan since 10 p.m. the previous night. Indeed, a check of the engine showed that it was cold, and there was no blood or physical evidence found in or outside the vehicle to suggest it had been used to transport Suya's body. As a result, the lead wound up going nowhere, and the investigation reached a standstill. Soo-young Kim tried to move on with his life, but ultimately decided that the memories of his wife's murder were so painful that he could not handle remaining in the United States. Less than 2 years after the crime, Soo-young shut down his businesses and returned to South Korea with his two sons. In October of 1993, the case was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, but it failed to generate any substantial new leads. So unfortunately, after nearly 30 years, the murder of Suya Kim continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So this is one of those dreaded unsolved mysteries cases in which there is virtually no additional information available, and the only real source I can use is the original segment from the show. In fact, this is one of the very few cases I covered in which I don't even know the victim's age. I can't even find any articles about Suya's murder at newspapers.com, but when you consider the time period this crime took place, I can't say I'm overly surprised. By 1991, the homicide rate in New York City had reached a record high, and there would be over 2,100 murders that year alone. That is just insane, and thankfully, the numbers have dropped drastically since then. But since Suya was killed in an era when the city was averaging 5 or 6 murders per day, I can see why even a crime as extreme as a Korean woman being stabbed 9 times and left in a dumpster wouldn't garner any significant news coverage. I think we can be grateful that Joe Jones just happened to stumble upon Suya's killer disposing of her body in the dumpster, because otherwise, there would have been zero evidence to work with, and this case probably wouldn't have been featured on Unsolved Mysteries. In fact, Suya's body was so concealed by trash that it's possible the dumpster would have been picked up without anybody noticing her, and she would still be a missing person to this day. This is an incredibly sad story, because Suya and her husband, Soo Young, came to America to provide a better life for themselves and their children, and their hard work was really starting to pay off for them. But this tragedy proved so devastating that Soo Young felt he had to take his family back to South Korea. Soo Young's Unsolved Mysteries interview would have been recorded around the approximate time period he decided to make the move back home, and he still looks incredibly grief-stricken about the loss of his wife. But in spite of this case getting exposure on national television, it sounds like there have been zero developments since then, and I have no idea how Soo Young and his sons are doing today. Anyway, before I start talking about the case, I thought I should provide you with an interesting piece of trivia. I always love spotting famous actors who started out their careers by playing roles in Unsolved Mysteries reenactments. Of course, the gold standard for that is Matthew McConaughey, but in this particular segment, you might recognize the actor playing Soo Young's brother as Daniel Dae Kim, who has since gone on to appear in a number of films and television shows, and is probably best known for playing the role of Jin Soo Kwon on the popular TV series Lost. But Unsolved Mysteries was one of his very first acting jobs. So this particular murder is unique in that we have a witness who directly interacted with the killer while he was covering up the crime, but we still don't know who the person is or the circumstances which led to him crossing paths with Suya in the first place. We know that Suya was last seen alive when she left her 2 boys with her grandmother to go shopping, but something obviously happened to her afterward. When Soo Young came home and discovered his wife was missing, he became particularly concerned when he noticed that Suya's car was still in the apartment building's parking garage. Since the engine was still cold, she obviously had not driven it recently, so you have to wonder if Suya's killer might have abducted her directly from the garage. Of course, we are talking about New York City here, where people are often inclined to take public transportation because driving and parking can be a nightmare, so I wondered if Suya simply elected not to take the car when she went shopping. However, the fact that Soo Young immediately became concerned when he saw the car was still there makes me wonder if Suya never used public transportation and if it was her usual habit to drive whenever she ran errands. All we know is that there was a window of around 10 hours between when Suya was last seen and her killer disposed of her body in the dumpster, and she had already been dead for hours before her body was found. Now, whenever you read online discussions about this case, one theory which is often thrown around is that Suya's killer was a man whom she'd been having a secret affair with, and that leaving her kids behind to go, quote-unquote, shopping while her husband was still at work was just a cover story. I hate to accuse a murder victim of cheating on her husband without any evidence to support it, but I can see why people would consider this theory. Perhaps the reason Suya left her car behind was because she went somewhere with this man in his vehicle before he ultimately killed her. But one of the main reasons I'm skeptical about this theory is that I get the impression Suya would not have even had enough time to conduct a secret affair. Remember, the Kims owned 2 separate clothing stores, and during his Unsolved Mysteries interview, Soo Young stated that they often worked from early morning until late at night, 7 days a week. The reason Soo Young immediately became concerned when Soo Ya failed to return home on the night she went missing was because he said she had never done anything like that during their entire 10-year marriage. It sounds to me like Soo Ya's entire life was her family and her business, so I think it would have been very difficult for her to be carrying on an affair under the radar without anyone noticing. But given that Soo Ya worked in a clothing store serving the public, I can't discount the possibility that her killer was a man who had been a customer at the store and developed an obsession with Soo Ya, which led to murder. It is interesting how Soo Ya's body was found nude, even though she was not raped. Police have never publicly stated whether they believe she was stabbed before or after she was nude, as I'm sure there probably would have been clothing fibers in her wounds if she was still dressed at the time. But the fact that she was stabbed 9 times does suggest a more personal killing, rather than Soo Ya being attacked by a random killer. Since Soo Ya's body was placed inside a dumpster, which was not easily visible from the street, police theorized that the killer was familiar with that particular neighborhood, and may have been a cab driver or a delivery man. If the delivery man theory is true, then it's possible that the killer had delivered to Soo Ya's store, which is how he became familiar with her in the first place. But I sure would like to know how or when Soo Ya originally encountered this guy on the day she was killed, as well as the exact location the murder took place. The man was dressed in a tank top and jogging shorts, which seems like unusual attire to wear when you're committing a murder, suggesting that the crime may not have been pre-planned. Since his tank top was described as being torn, Soo Ya may have attempted to put up a fight before he killed her. Whatever happened, I'm sure the killer did not expect anyone to stumble upon him, disposing of Soo Ya's body in that dumpster at 3 a.m. So now we have to talk about the security guard who made that discovery, Joe Jones, who is one of the more colorful characters ever interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries. I've always found it amusing how upfront Jones was about the fact that he accepted a $20 bribe because he initially assumed this guy was just dumping trash rather than a body. Jones's story is so crazy that I can see why people might assume he made the whole thing up, but he did pass a polygraph test, and police seemed satisfied that he was telling the truth. Indeed, if Jones was lying, I don't think he would make up the detail about the $20, since that's the sort of thing which could get him fired. However, the most confusing aspect of this case is the license number from the killer's car. As you recall, Jones claimed that the vehicle was a blue Nissan, and when police ran the license number he provided, it was matched to a blue Nissan belonging to a Taiwanese exchange student. I know that investigators became satisfied that this car was not connected to the crime, so I guess you could assume that Jones might have gotten the license number wrong. But if he did, it's a pretty astonishing coincidence that it would be matched to another vehicle with the exact same make, model, and color that Jones described. So I have to feel there's something missing from this part of the story, or certain details have gotten confused. Even if this exchange student had no involvement in the crime, could the killer have stolen or borrowed her vehicle? I know police checked the engine of the Nissan and determined that it hadn't been driven in a while, but this still would have been several hours after the discovery of Soo Ya's body, so I'm not sure if that means a whole lot. However, I do think it's very telling that no traces of blood were found anywhere in or outside the car. We're talking about transporting the body of a woman who was stabbed 9 times, and traces of blood were seen on the killer's tank top and on the ground next to the dumpster. So if Soo Ya was inside that car, the killer likely would have needed to do an incredibly thorough cleaning up job in a very short amount of time, something which I'm sure would have been noticeable to investigators. But if that Nissan wasn't used in the commission of this crime, how did Jones get its license number? Well, even though the Unsolved Mysteries segment gives off the impression that Jones saw the full plate number, here's an exact quote from a detective who was interviewed. Quote, "We ran all the Nissans that fit the description with the plate number in New York City, and we tried to match registered owners by using a partial plate, and we were able to come up with one match." End quote. So does this mean that Jones only actually saw a partial license number? If true, then this makes a lot more sense, as it would have meant the police were using a specific search criteria involving all blue Nissans in the New York area containing some of those numbers, rather than attempting to make an exact match. Given that Jones only saw the license plate for a few moments inside a dark alley, it's believable that he might not have gotten all the numbers correct. So who could Suya's killer have been? While I sometimes see this crime pop up in online discussions about the Long Island serial killer, which has become one of the most heavily dissected cold cases of recent memory. But even though the Kims owned a second clothing store in Long Island, Suya's body was found in Brooklyn, and this crime took place nearly 2 decades before the other Long Island serial killings, so I highly doubt there's a connection. One person who has been named as a potential candidate to be the man from the alley is notorious serial killer Joel Rifkin, who was convicted of the murders of 9 women in New York City between 1989 and 1993, though he is believed to have at least 17 victims. Rifkin wore glasses and would have been 32 years old at the time Suya was killed, and while he does bear a bit of a resemblance to the composite sketch, there are things which don't match, as Rifkin was not blonde, and he had a mustache at the time he was arrested, though I guess it's not impossible that he could have been clean-shaven for a time in 1991. Given the time period, you certainly can't discount the possibility of Rifkin being Suya's killer, especially when you consider that he murdered another Korean woman named Yun Lee just over 2 months later, in September of 1991. But overall, Suya's murder really doesn't fit Rifkin's MO, as he mostly targeted sex workers, and he often liked to strangle his victims to death before dismembering their bodies. Stabbing a woman 9 times just seems like a much more personal killing, and I still get the impression that Suya's killer knew her personally. This just seemed like an unplanned, sloppily handled crime in which the killer just got incredibly lucky that he was able to remain unidentified even though he was caught in the act by an eyewitness. In most cities, if the events of this crime had been carried out in the exact same fashion, this case might have been solved relatively quickly. But since this was New York City in 1991, where an overburdened police force was dealing with multiple homicides every single day, this one ended up slipping through the cracks. If the crime was not committed by a serial killer, and this was the perpetrator's first murder, then it's possible they might have just returned to living a normal life again, and are still out there somewhere today. I know that nearly 30 years have passed, but if by chance you happen to have any information on the unsolved murder of Suya Kim, please contact the appropriate authorities. So now let's move on to our next case. Our second story also begins in New York City, this time in 1997, and our central figure is 11-year-old Quinn Rong Wu. Quinn Rong was originally born in a tiny rural village in the Guangdong province of China to her father Xun Cheng Wu and her mother Yu Qin Wu, but for the first 8 years of her life, she was unable to spend much time living with them. During the late 1970s, in order to control its growing population, China instituted what was known as a family planning policy, which prevented parents from giving birth to more than one child per household. At the time Quinn Rong was born, she already had a sister named Hua Rong, who was 6 years older than her, so Quinn Rong was forced to spend her childhood living at a cousin's home located several miles away from her parents. The Wus would later give birth to a son named Jia Rong, who was 4 years younger than Quinn Rong, before eventually making the decision to leave China and emigrate to the United States. By January of 1996, the Wus had finally saved up enough money to move to New York City and were able to take all 3 of their children along, including Quinn Rong. They would settle into a tenement apartment located on Henry Street in the Chinatown section of Manhattan's Lower East Side. Even though the apartment was very cramped and only consisted of 2 6x6-foot rooms, this marked the first time the entire family was able to live together in the same home. Xun Cheng got an overnight job at a noodle factory, while Yu Qin worked part-time as a seamstress in a garment factory called NBC Connections Incorporated, but while the parents worked long hours and struggled to make ends meet, they still had aspirations for their children to obtain an education and a better future for themselves. Quinn Rong was a 5th-grade student at Public School 2, located on Henry Street, only a few blocks from her apartment. The school had a large number of students who were Chinese immigrants and taught bilingual classes, but Quinn Rong spoke very little English and often struggled with her grades. But even though she had some difficulties adapting to life in America, Quinn Rong was known for generally being a happy, positive child. On the morning of May 13th, Quinn Rong and her mother left their apartment in order to walk to public school 2 together. According to Yu Qin, they were only about 100 yards away from the school when she kissed her daughter goodbye and headed back to her apartment to cook breakfast for her son. Yu Qin assumed that Quinn Rong would be able to walk the remainder of the route by herself without issue, but something apparently happened to her before she arrived. No one recalled seeing Quinn Rong in school that day, and when her family was informed that she did not show up, they searched the neighborhood for her without success, before contacting the police to report her missing. In spite of an extensive search, the next 2 weeks would turn up no trace of Quinn Rong, until an eyewitness came forward to report some very unusual sightings of her on the day she went missing. According to the witness, at around 9:20 a.m. on the morning of May 13th, she saw an Asian girl resembling Quinn Rong in the company of a large, bearded white male who appeared to be between 40 and 50 years old. They both got on the B 6th Avenue Express subway train, aka the B train, at Grand Street Station and headed northbound. The witness said the girl was crying and that her male companion took her off the train at the West 4th Street Station. Well, believe it or not, the witness would claim they encountered this very same girl and man together on another subway train later that day. This time, the sighting took place at around 3:45 p.m. on a B train traveling southbound from Manhattan to Brooklyn, though the witness would get off the train before she could find out which stop the man and girl were traveling to. The eyewitness sighting would be published in the newspapers on May 28th, but unfortunately, later that same day, Quinn Rong's body would be discovered in the East River near the Manhattan Bridge. She was still dressed in the same clothing she had been wearing on the morning she disappeared, and strangulation marks were found on her neck, which indicated that the killer had strangled her to death with their bare hands. It seemed apparent that Quinn Rong was killed a short time after she disappeared and had been in the river for days, but the water had washed away most of the forensic evidence. While the medical examiner's office would find bruises on Quinn Rong's vaginal area to suggest possible sexual abuse, they never actually confirmed if she was sexually assaulted. The crime caused such a stir in New York that a number of notable figures would attend Quinn Rong's funeral, including Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who personally offered his condolences on behalf of the city. Over $100,000 in donations were raised for the Wu family by supporters, and things eventually reached the point where Xun Sheng said that he did not want anyone to donate any more money to him because he preferred to work for it. While some of the money would be used to help cover Quinn Rong's funeral costs, most of it wound up in trust after Xun Sheng opened up savings account for the future education of his two remaining children. A composite sketch of the bearded white male supposedly seen with Quinn Rong was circulated throughout the media, and a few people thought he bore a resemblance to a local homeless man named John Hayward. Hayward was questioned a few times, but the witness from the subway failed to pick him out of a police lineup, and he soon disappeared from the area. Investigators also looked into the possibility of Quinn Rong's case being connected to a predator known as the Chinatown Rapist, who had assaulted several young Asian girls at knife point in 1994 and was never caught, but this lead never went anywhere either. One of the biggest obstacles in the investigation was the language barrier between the police and the Wu family, which often made communication difficult. The Wus would soon retain the services of a lawyer and express their belief that they were being unfairly harassed by the police. At one point, they were subject to an 8-hour interrogation session which lasted from 6 p.m. until 2 a.m. For their part, the police expressed suspicion over the fact that the Wus never attempted to contact them for updates about the case, but Xun Sheng responded to this by stating, quote, "I didn't go to them. I wasn't sure if I should ask them or not," end quote. Strange stories would soon surface from NBC Connections Incorporated, the garment factory where Yu Qin worked, as employees claimed that she often brought her children to the factory and made Quinn Rong do work on the sewing machine beside her. They claimed that Yu Qin often scolded and insulted her daughter while she worked, and would punish Quinrong by only allowing her to eat rice for her meals, even though her younger brother got to eat meat and rice. While Yuqin admitted to bringing Quinrong to the factory on a few occasions because she couldn't afford childcare, she denied ever mistreating her, and while she allowed Quinrong to play with her sewing machine a few times for fun, she never forced her daughter to work. Indeed, the factory's owner claimed that 6 months prior to Quinrong's death, regulations had been implemented which forbade children from entering the factory, and that Quinrong had actually been turned away by security on two separate occasions. Investigators were most troubled by an odd discrepancy involving a third daughter the Wus allegedly had while still living in China. The parents each shared completely different stories with the police, as Yuqin claimed the child died shortly after birth and was dumped in a river, while Xun Sheng said the child was born sick and abandoned outside a hospital. Investigators attempted to obtain more information about this by speaking with officials from the Chinese consulate, but received no cooperation from them. In spite of the tragic loss of Quinrong, the Wus decided that they still wanted to remain in America, and they would eventually move into a different apartment in Chinatown. In a 2001 New York Daily News article about the case, one anonymous police source stated, quote, "We've done an extensive investigation, and the answer lies with someone close to her," end quote. In spite of this, the police were unable to turn up any evidence to implicate anyone in Quinrong's murder, and after 2 decades, there are still no answers about who actually killed her. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So like I mentioned in the intro to this episode, you can make many parallels between this story and the murder of Suya Kim, but sadly, one of them seems to be that the investigation hit a standstill and the case has completely faded from the spotlight. The murder of Quinrong Wu was obviously a pretty big deal at the time it originally happened, since it compelled Mayor Giuliani himself to attend her funeral, but I haven't seen any media coverage about this case since the New York Times ran an article about it in 2005, much like the Kim family. I have no idea what Quinrong's parents and siblings are doing today, or if they're even still in New York City. But unlike the Kim case, there has been suspicion that the victim's family may have been involved in what happened to her. Before Suya was murdered, the Kims had been in America for years, working hard to build a successful business, and were at the point where they were living comfortably in a spacious apartment. By contrast, the Wus had only been in the US for 18 months and experiencing a number of struggles. They were living in a cramped two-room apartment that was nowhere near adequate enough for a family with 3 kids, but it still ran them $700 per month in rent. Jun Sheng's weekly salary for working 11-hour overnight shifts at the noodle factory was only $290 per week, while Yuqin's weekly take-home pay from her part-time job at the garment factory was only about $100, so you can see how they would have struggled to make ends meet. Added to the fact that Quinrong seemed to be experiencing culture shock from her move to America, and wasn't doing particularly well in school, you can see why there has been speculation that she could have been murdered by her own parents because they considered her to be too much of a burden. Now, it must be stated that at no point have the police ever named the Wus as suspects or accused them of being responsible for what happened, and the closest we have to that is a cryptic quote from an anonymous source about the answer lying with someone close to her. On one hand, we do have an eyewitness sighting of Quinrong on the subway with a bearded white male shortly after she went missing, which, if accurate, would suggest an abduction by a predator. But on the other hand, there also don't seem to be any other independent eyewitnesses who could confirm seeing Quinrong on the morning she disappeared. We really only have the word of her mother that she walked Quinrong partway to school before they went their separate ways, meaning that if Quinrong was abducted, it had to occur during the remaining 100 yards on her route. But of course, that's certainly not impossible, as there are numerous documented cases of children being abducted in a very limited window of time without anyone seeing anything. Quite frankly, I think that many of the things which supposedly made the parents look suspicious were simply the result of cultural differences. The police said they found it odd that the Wus never contacted them to ask for any updates about the investigation, but the way Xun Sheng responded gives me the impression that he genuinely didn't know he could do that. Remember, this family originally hailed from a rural village in China, and I have no idea what kind of interactions they would have had with the police before they moved to America. For all we know, the Wus might have been raised with the mentality that you should not bother the police and just trust them to do their job, which is why they never took the initiative to keep inquiring about the status of Quinrong's case. Quite frankly, it is a bit unsettling that police would hold the attitude that anyone who doesn't frequently ask about their investigation into the murder of a loved one must not care, or they have something to hide. If the Wus had been refusing to cooperate, or they immediately left town, or decided to skip the country to return to China, that would be one thing, but they decided to remain in New York, and even kept sending their son to the same school where Quinrong had attended. Yes, before the murder, they probably couldn't have afforded to move anywhere, but remember, they wound up receiving over $100,000 in donations from supporters. From what I've read, there was apparently some controversy about this, as one community leader thought the money was going to be used to establish a children's protection foundation named after Quinrong, but Xun Sheng elected to place it in trust for his children's education. In addition, Xun Sheng could have potentially received more money had he not publicly stated that he wanted the donations to stop because he wanted to work for it. The entire reason the Wus moved to America to begin with was to provide a better future for their children, and their actions following Quinrong's murder seemed to suggest this was still their intention. There were also allegations that Quinrong's mother was mistreating her and forcing the girl to work the sewing machine at her garment factory. I know the factory owner came to Yuqin's defense and denied this, but, well, if he was employing child labor, I have my doubts he would admit to this. The Wus were struggling financially, so I won't discount the possibility that Yuqin could have made her daughter do some work for additional money, but even if that is true, that doesn't necessarily mean they would have killed her. I guess the thing which raised the most eyebrows with investigators was when the parents mentioned losing an additional daughter in China shortly after she was born, but they each provided completely different stories about what happened to her. Well, in order to address this, we have to talk a bit more about China's family planning policy and their population control issues. In the late 1970s, the country officially implemented a policy that families could only give birth to one child per household, though they would alter this a bit a few years later. In China, sons are valued much more highly than daughters, so if a rural family gave birth to a daughter during that time period, they would be granted one more opportunity to have a son and allowed to conceive a second child. While the Wus were definitely a rural family and already had one daughter when Quinrong was born in 1986. So technically, this was their last chance to have a son, which would probably explain why they sent Quinrong away to be raised by a cousin until they had her brother, Jierong, 4 years later, and then eventually left the country. Now, if a family was caught violating the one- or two-child policy, there could be pretty severe punishments, such as forced abortion, mandatory contraception or sterilization, and a serious financial penalty. For this reason, there were reports of a massive increase of female infanticide after the policy was implemented, as parents would give birth to a daughter and then decide to secretly kill or abandon the child so they would have another opportunity to conceive a son. It's unclear when exactly this third daughter of the Wus was born, but if the child did not actually die of natural causes, I could see why it would be tempting to believe that the family got rid of her. If true, then yes, that is pretty horrific, but the Wus would have been far from the only parents in China to do something like that during that time period. I'm sure it's tempting to believe that if the Wus were capable of killing one daughter, they would be capable of killing another, but in an odd way, these allegations make it seem even more unlikely that they murdered Quinrong. Think about it. If Quinrong's parents didn't want her, there are many ways they could have gotten rid of her right after she was born, but instead, they went to the trouble of hiding her with a relative for 8 years. I don't think they would have bothered going through all that if they didn't care for her, especially when you consider that their main reason for emigrating to America was so that they could finally live together as a family for the first time and provide a better future for their children. If they never wanted Quinn Song to begin with, they could have just left her behind in China with the relative who raised her. I just can't reconcile the idea that Xun Shang and Yu Qin would go to all that trouble to protect Quinn Song for years, but then only 18 months after getting a fresh start in a new country, they decide their daughter has become too much of a burden that they decide to kill her. If that was their intention, it would have been a lot easier to get away with it in rural China than the world's largest city, where a murdered child is going to attract a lot more attention. I know it's never officially been made clear if Quinn Rong was sexually assaulted or not, but her vaginal area apparently did show signs of bruising. Unless there was already a prior history of sexual abuse in the Wu household, it seems pretty extreme for Quinn Rong's parents to do that if their primary motive for getting rid of her was to relieve themselves of a financial burden. Overall, it really does seem more logical to me that Quinn Rong was the victim of a random predator rather than her own family, and I think that many of the police's suspicions about the Wus may have been caused by cultural differences. However, I guess I can see why investigators were so focused on them, since they had very little evidence to work with. The only thing which really pointed to another suspect were the eyewitness sightings of Quinn Rong with the bearded white male on the subway, but I do think there's good reason to be skeptical of them, especially when you consider that the same witness saw them together on different trains at different times throughout the day, about 6 hours apart. I think that the odds against something like that happening in a city as large as New York have to be astronomical, especially when you consider that Quinn Rong was supposed to be this man's captive. There are a few discussion threads about this case on Reddit, and it's interesting to read comments from people who have lived in this area who point out that the geography of these sightings make no sense. The first sighting of Quinn Rong and the man took place less than an hour after she supposedly parted ways from her mother, as they were seen getting on the B train at Grand Street Station. But the problem is that Quinn Rong went missing 100 yards from her school, which is located only about a block away from the East Broadway station for New York's F train. So if Quinn Rong was abducted by this man before she reached the school, it would make a lot more sense to take that route rather than walk several blocks to the Grand Street station, which is about a half mile away. Quinn Rong and the man were also seen on a train heading northbound before they got off at the West 4th Street station, yet when the same witness saw them again on a train later that afternoon, they were apparently heading in the complete opposite direction from Manhattan to Brooklyn. 2 weeks later, Quinn Rong's body would be discovered in the East River near the Manhattan Bridge, which is only a couple blocks south from her school. So if both these witnesses' sightings were accurate, then that means that Quinn Rong's killer abducted her and took her north, but then inexplicably decided to get back onto a public train with his captive hours later and take her back to the area she was originally abducted from in order to strangle her to death and toss her body into the river. Why take such a huge risk? Hell, Quinn Rong and the man were seen getting off at the West 4th Street station that morning, which is in relatively close proximity to the Hudson River, so why not get rid of her body there rather than traveling back to the Lower East Side? It just makes more sense to me that whoever killed Quinn Rong never left the area before tossing her body into the East River. I don't know what the deal with this eyewitness was, but I think she was either lying or simply saw a completely different Asian girl with a bearded white male on the train that day. But unfortunately, if you discount the sighting of this bearded man, then there's virtually nothing else to go on. I do think the most logical explanation is that Quinn Rong was abducted by someone before she reached the school who subsequently murdered her, but I have no idea who it could have been. After all this time, this murder will be very difficult to solve, and I'm not even sure if genetic genealogy would help, since it's unclear if the perpetrator left any DNA behind. If it actually was Quinrong's family who were responsible for her death, then they covered their tracks pretty well and have managed to get away with it for 2 decades. Whatever happened, I really hope that this poor girl receives justice someday, so if by chance you happen to have any information on the unsolved murder of Quinrong Wu, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about either of these cases I've discussed, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I covered another classic case from Unsolved Mysteries about the bizarre ransom kidnapping of business executive John Grundhofer, who was abducted by a bumbling, unidentified criminal who somehow managed to avoid getting caught. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Stephanie D., Christina P., Wade S., Cameron D., Joshua S., Carol, Ginger S., and Madison A. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I would like to play a promo for another true crime podcast, Sooner State True Crime.
Hey, The Trail Went Cold listeners. Cece here, the host of the Sooner State True Crime podcast. We focus on cases based in my wonderful home state of Oklahoma. And since the term Sooner actually refers to the state's very first true crime, Cheaters in the Land Run, Oklahoma is definitely a crime state. Sooner State True Crime can be found in most podcast apps or visit our website anchor.fm/crimestate. New episodes are released twice a month. Follow us on Twitter @crimestate for upcoming episodes and more. So come away with me and discover my crime state on the Sooner State True Crime Podcast.
I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, which has some very interesting posts about this case. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a great week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶